Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie again. I was about
to say. No, I'm not, actually.
Oh, you're not. You're Emily Rooney. I got so confused.
We're staring out the window.
Right. Gloria Steinem is seconds away from coming here. The name of her book, I'm going to say this again in a couple of minutes, is Gloria Steinem, My Life on the Road, which is really terrific.
I ate up the entire thing. I read every single word of it.
Yesterday afternoon after the show and read most of the book.
I started it over the weekend. And then I finished it up yesterday afternoon after the show. And, I mean, I was actually recommending it over the weekend. I always say I hate these questions when people ask me, what are you reading?
What are you reading?
I was reading this book. No, anyway, do you recommend anything? And I was saying, yes. As a matter of fact, I'm reading this Gloria Steinem book, and I really, really recommend it because it's
so Spotlight unusual. The movie and My Life on the Road by Gloria Steinem. Is that correct?
Yes. I think she's coming.
Unfortunately, she's not coming. So thanks so much for tuning in. No, she is. She's out in the hall. She'll be here in any second.
Door is opening.
In fact, there she
is.
Oh,
we're so excited.
Hello, Gloria
Steinem. Hello.
I'm Jim Browdy. How are you?
Hi. Gloria, so, Emily.
Gloria Steinem. Actually, you need headphones for this, Gloria, to hear yourself speak, which I don't know how you feel about it. Well, you have no choice. You're going to have to hear yourself. Here it is. Gloria Steinem has a new biography out that Emily and I have been raving about. It's called My Life on the Road. But when she started out as a writer, she, along with so many women, were not taken terribly seriously.
When it came to assignments as a freelance writer, I was assigned things about fashion and food and makeup and babies or the low point of my life. Textured stockings. When I delivered the articles to my editor at the Sunday Times magazine, he generally gave me a choice, like either I could go to a hotel room with him in the afternoon or mail his letters on the way out. Needless to say, I mailed the letters, but I just assumed you had to put up with this.
Obviously, that's the voice of Gloria Steinem, who in decades of writing and activism has changed so much. She's in town today to talk about her new book, My Life on the Road. We are thrilled to meet you, Gloria. Thanks so much for being here.
Excited all week. I was saying to Jim earlier this morning, Gloria, that when I started reading this book, I feel like I've always known so much about you, who you are, how you think. I've read all your writings, and I was absolutely flabbergasted to read about your childhood, your upbringing, the fact that you didn't go to school until after you were 10 years old. You led a very nomadic life, which is a kind way of putting it. You really didn't have a home. You didn't have a home for most of your adult life. Your mother had been institutionalized. She had a number of problems, which probably would be diagnosed as schizophrenia or something like that today. But, I mean, I guess my first question is, how did that affect you? Did it, not having a formal education?
Well, when you're describing me, I was finding myself thinking, this is the experience of being on the road. If you talk to someone, you discover their unique story. And you figure out that the signals you thought you knew about who they were are really only 10% of it. Yes, it affected me in ways that I only realize in later life. You know, at the time, I wanted to go to school like other kids, as we all want to be like, you know, what we see in the movies. But in later life, I realized that it was not such a bad thing, really, that I didn't go to school because I escaped a certain amount of brainwashing into Dick and Jane books and so on.
You read the Hardy Boys, too, by the way.
I thought
I was the only boy who read the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew. You were a woman who read Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys.
You see,
is that correct?
We were fated to meet.
Simpatico, exactly. When you're writing, it took you a mere 20 years to write this. Is that right?
Yeah.
20
well,
years.
Not exactly 20 years. It's just that I would work on it in the summer when I wasn't so much on the road and then drop it for 11 months.
Did you remember things as you were going through the process of writing about your childhood that weren't in your regular recall when you were just living your life?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like what?
I think whenever we write anything of any length, we discover a lot about ourselves that we hadn't had the contemplative time. I mean, I did not at first include a chapter about my father at all because I was just going to write about my movement life on the road. And then after I sat down, I thought, wait a minute, you know, maybe that I grew up in a trailer for the first 10 years of my life has something to do with the fact that I am at home on the road. And also that I was living an insecure life from an outside point of view, that is, my father was really proud of never having a job.
you early in the book, you talk about how traveling alone, women on the road, got a bad rap, that there was always these perils associated with women traveling alone, from Amelia Earhart to Thelma and Louise. I laughed out loud. And then even reporters like Laura Logan, who was viciously raped in Egypt, and she was a woman in a situation where she probably shouldn't have been. But then when you think about what happens at home, you know, domestic violence and in other countries, mercy killings and honor killings, the dangers of being at home are equal, if not greater.
Yeah, we think of the road as mainly male territory, and it has been from Jack Kerouac back into, you know, for centuries. It's been treated that way, the quest, the hero's quest, and so on. And I did want to say, look, the road belongs to all of us, and to encourage women to travel too. But it was only after I was writing it that I thought, wait a minute, you know, look at the statistics. Actually, the most dangerous place for an American woman is in her own home. That's the place she's most likely to be beaten or killed by a man she knows. So ironically, statistically speaking, the road is safer than home for women.
You know, Gloria Steinem, we're meeting you today, but I have to say, as someone who's also followed you incredibly closely, I'm always struck by your stunning optimism. Is that No, I'm a cup one quarter full kind of guy. But wait, it's called what? What were you about
to say? It's called being a hopeaholic.
Well, maybe, but it's a wonderful quality. But I read somewhere that you said, in part, it was being a traveling soul that gave birth to this optimism. What does one have to do with the other?
Well, I think if you are traveling and you are vulnerable and, you know, you're open to people, you listen to them, and you discover that the act of being vulnerable, listening, paying attention, often brings out a pretty good person in them. You know, it's the tyranny of expectation. Mm-hmm. In a way, we could be divided. I don't want to, you know, the world is divided into two kinds of people, those who divide everything into two and those who don't. So
I thought it was those who love Neil Diamond and those who don't. Isn't that what it's divided into?
But so I hate to do that, but I'm about to do it again by saying that I think people who view the world and the universe as basically friendly have different experiences from those who view it as basically unfriendly. And I don't know whether this is inherited. You know, to some extent, shyness, they say, is inherited. I suspect it's mostly about the way we are treated as children. Mm-hmm. That makes that determination. But to some extent, I mean, I don't want to blame the victim here, but to some extent, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
You had a lot of life-altering events. In fact, so many, I'm not going to be able to enumerate here. Most of us only have one or two, and it's usually something like marriage or the birth of a child. But you talk about March on Washington, and later, of course, the 1977 National Women's Conference in Houston. But just starting with the March on Washington, you said when you were first in that crowd, you didn't really notice the fact that there were no women speakers, and you were with somebody you just happened to meet who mentioned it to you.
I was just accepting it, as I think we do accept as normal what we've grown up with or what is around us, and only because of accidentally marching in that way that you end up for hours with people you don't know, you know. And a woman who was you know, kind of angry, you know, that there were no women speaking. And she was calling out names, you know, where are they?
Put it in context. Well, for people who don't know what the march was about.
Well, this was the first big, huge march on Washington of the civil rights movement. It was quite controversial because the fear was that to marshal this, many people would either turn into violence or there would not be enough people, and that in either case it might endanger the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1963. But Martin Luther King and everyone who planned the march continued anyway, and it turned out to be huge. You know, it was, I mean, not only in numbers, but as a turning point in national consciousness, because people had come there from all over the country. It was not violent. It was very self-consciously peaceful, and an ocean of people, all peaceful. And Martin Luther King's speech lives on with us. You know, I have a dream, with Lincoln seated behind him.
Yeah.
It was, you know, nothing happens in one moment. Of course, you know, endless years had gone into this, but it was as if finally the African-American part parts of the nation and the European American support for them had said, this is our country, this is our capital, we're here.
By the way, your agent is going to be very disappointed. You haven't mentioned the name of your book even once. It's My Life on the Road. You're supposed to say that every other sentence. You know, one of the things, when you're talking about the March on Washington, just for another minute, Gloria Steinem, you wrote, I think I got this right, you said you didn't intend to go, but you ended up just going, meaning it's almost as if it was like a divining rod kind of thing. You just what did you mean by that?
Well, I had tried to get an assignment, a journalistic assignment.
You were
a
freelance kid.
To write about
it. Right?
Yeah, freelancing. I couldn't get an assignment. I had nothing to do there. You know, I wasn't, you know, serving any useful purpose. But it just was like a magnet. I don't even know why. Mm. I don't know why. Maybe it was partly having lived in India for a couple of years and realizing that there are these huge watershed moments at which people gather. I don't know. I just found myself going.
Do you remember the physics? When I've heard great speeches, and I've only heard a few in my life in person, Robert Kennedy on a street corner in my hometown in Philadelphia, Cuomo speech. Do you remember the physical feel? Do you remember the feeling when you heard King utter the words that practically every school kid can recite? Mm-hmm. Do you remember that moment? Is this still in you?
You know, it is, but I think it's been so reinforced by hearing the speech over again later. Mm-hmm. I think in the moment, what I was seeing standing, because I had a press pass, so I was able to stand on the steps, was looking at this ocean of humanity, all peaceful, respectful of each other. You know, I'd never seen anything like that before. Even in India, where there are, you know, massive, massive meetings, I hadn't seen quite that kind of vista.
You say that you divided your life into the before and after of the 1977 National Women's Conference in Houston, Texas. I think that's an event that just bypassed most of us. Mm-hmm. I think I'll speak for myself. I don't remember it. I mean, I was out of college by then. It's probably something I was in the news business. Why was it so meaningful to you, and how come it didn't have the kind of legs?
You're right. I mean, it is the most important event nobody knows about. But it was a kind of constitutional convention for women, you might say, because we had not been at the first one. And Bella Abzug and Patsy Mink and Shirley Chisholm, who were concerned about the representation of American women's views in the International Year of the Woman, which then became the Decade of the Woman, as declared by the United Nations, because we had first been represented by a group of people appointed by President Ford and headed by a guy from the State Department. And I think, you know, we said, wait a minute, you know, what issues, what concerns do American women really want to bring up? And thanks to those three members of Congress, we got actually tax-funded, although at a very low level, a national conference that was preceded by identifying issues and electing delegates in every state and territory, and was had to be racially and economically representative. I think it might be the only racially and economically representative meeting of that size that I've ever seen. So we had spent 2 years helping groups in state by state to have, I mean, for instance, there were 20,000 women in Albany alone in New York State. And it went on for 2 days, you know, selecting issues, selecting delegates.
To go to this conference.
To go to this conference. Yeah. And then, at the conference, there were 2,000 elected delegates.
Wow.
But part of the problem was that there was across town a right-wing Phyllis Schlafly, Robert Dornan. Remember Robert Dornan?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Absolutely.
Right. The congressman from, very right-wing congressman from California. And they were holding a meeting, a counter meeting. They were elected by no one. You know, it was not at all comparable. But the press, in its process of being so-called even-handed, gave it equal coverage much of the time. So that's part of the reason people didn't understand the importance of Houston. But it was crucial because it brought together a majority women's movement around issues, including what had been controversial issues like lesbian rights or safe and legal abortion, and it turned out that those were actually majority issues.
So we're talking to Gloria Steinem. Would you just call yourself a hopeaholic? Is that what you said a couple of minutes ago?
It's true, I am. I have to confess to that. Right.
Okay, so hopeaholic. That was 1977. Let me do the math. That's 38 years ago. How are we doing? I mean, how are we doing on issues that you've spent your lifetime fighting over?
Well, I think the good news is that these are now majority issues in the country. If you look at public opinion polls, they are supported by the majority of Americans, women and men, and those issues weren't even named before. They didn't have names before. So that's a huge change in consciousness. And we also now have a lot of laws and processes that we didn't have before. You know, take domestic violence, and that was the term didn't exist. Mm-hmm. The idea of, excuse me, of success on the part of a lot of police officers was getting the victim and the criminal back together. Mm-hmm. You know, that
right.
So for it to become a named national issue with reform of laws and police department procedures and so on, since it's the single biggest, not only the single biggest source of violence, but the single biggest determinant of other violence. If you have violence in the household, in your family, you're more likely to repeat it or to think it's normal or inevitable in the rest of life. So, you know, that's just one of, 30 or so huge issue areas that have changed. But because it's now a majority movement, we also have had, since the late 80s, really, a backlash of people who really believe that there is a natural order of things and that has to do with sex and race and class, and they're against all of these. We, you know, because we had a frontlash, now we have a backlash.
So are you just on that one topic, would you describe yourself as an incrementalist? As you were speaking, I'm saying, I don't have any idea what the numbers were. When you started doing the work you've devoted your lifetime to, how many women were in Congress? 5? 10? I have no idea.
Yeah, no.
So there are 100 now. That's still only, 22, 23%, which is pathetic. But are you the kind of person who says we're on a path to a goal, so that's great progress? Or do you get really disappointed that we've made so little on fronts, never had a woman president? We'll talk about that in a minute. How do you react to those things?
You know, both. I mean, I think in the beginning I thought it would be much easier, not easier exactly, but I thought if we got the majority we would win. I didn't understand we don't exactly have a democracy. I mean, you know, people with a lot of money and clout, you know, can make more noise. I do think that we kind of have to be, I don't know if I would say incrementalist, but one of the things I learned at Houston from the women from Indian country there, who were from many different tribes and nations, was a saying, which is, it takes 4 generations to heal 1 act of violence. Hmm. So, you know, I think we need to think in the long term much more than we do.
When you first burst onto the scene, there was a great deal of focus on your appearance. You even write about it. You say you were first described as pretty, and then the more popular and more well-known you became, you were described as beautiful. Is that always going to be something that follows women around, regardless of their competence? When you look at Hillary Clinton or some of the other women leaders, I mean, certainly Bella Abzug was never called beautiful. She had all the other adjectives that went with her, or Golda Meir. But the appearance of a female, is that always going to be part of the equation?
No, it's not always. I don't think it's always going to be. It's much less than it used to be. I mean, we used to be only viable up to 30, say, you know, in public life, and certainly in the entertainment industry. So it's kind of letting up a little bit decade by decade, but there is still a huge amount of emphasis on how women look that is not on men in the same way, to men's detriment. You know, because actually men's health suffers because nobody cares about pot bellies, just about what's in their wallet, you know. So, right.
Why are you looking at me when you're saying that, Gloria Steinem?
I am not looking at you.
Gloria, since Emily brought up Hillary Clinton, correct me if I'm wrong, did you not say America was not ready for a woman president when she ran against Obama? Is that correct?
Yeah, I thought that. I didn't say it because I didn't want it to be a self-fulfilling prophecy, but I did not think she could.
Why were we not ready then, and are we ready now?
Well, I don't know if we're ready now, but I think it's possible. Then I didn't think so because we had not seen enough women honored in authority in public life And so we continue to associate female authority with childhood, since most of us have been raised, women and men have been raised by women. Therefore, female authority seems to us emotional or nurturing or anyways tied to the inner world, not appropriate in the outer world. We just haven't seen it. And we do what we see more than what we're told. Now I think there have been enough women in public life, in authority, so that we can begin to entertain it. It's still going to be very, very difficult, very difficult. But I think it's possible.
So does it drive you nuts on that front? Well, many people, you wrote an op-ed in support, am I not right about this, in support of Hillary Clinton right before New Hampshire last time?
Yes, and it was really talking about her bad treatment in the press and
but
elsewhere.
And while some people credit that, a lot of people credit that, with giving her the boost she needed, at least an equal number, if not greater, what I thought of this when you mentioned the emotional leadership, I think was the term you used, mm-hmm. of women, which was more recognized than other kinds of leadership, I would say a larger body of people think that when she wept in that bar or restaurant in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, you were?
Yep.
That was what turned, oh, my God, Hillary Clinton is a human being. Oh, my God, Hillary Clinton has emotions. That sort of thing.
Well, the press treated it, in my memory anyway, you can correct me, but no. I think the press
I was
treated
in the room
it
and
as a negative.
They played it as a negative, and it wasn't, and not in that room.
No, I think that's what was interesting about it, that there was a masculine model of leadership that assumed a lack of emotionality. And therefore, the media felt it would be negative, and it turned out to be humanizing, you know, which men and women are human beings. Hello, you know, so it turned out to be.
Well, the media turned it on because she was actually responding to a question about her appearance and how hard it was for her to get up every morning and do the hair and the makeup and be concerned about, you know, having her pantsuit pressed and all that. And it was just a very brief moment that she choked up. And being in the room, it came across as very human. But I recall afterwards, Jim, it indeed did become. But you actually campaigned for her, and you said that being a non-surrogate gave you a lot of freedom because you could say whatever you wanted to say.
Yeah,
you're just supporting her.
Yeah,
how did that make a difference?
I try never anymore to be part of a campaign because what that means is you can only say what the candidate says. Mm. And I want to be free to be, to say more, to be critical, to be whatever. You know, I mean, I don't see, I mean, I'm glad there's a campaign and it serves a purpose, but those of us outside the campaign can serve an additional purpose.
We're talking to Gloria Steinem. Since she won't promote her work, I will. Her book is called My Life on the Road, and it is terrific. I want you to settle a dispute for me. One of the most fun days I ever had in my life, I used to live in New York City. I was a legal services lawyer. I did an event with a woman you knew very well, Flo Kennedy. Now, Flo Kennedy, I thought, had maybe the best line ever. And the line was, and if I get a little bit wrong, you're correct, if men could get pregnant, abortion would be a sacrament. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. But we both got it from an Irish woman taxi driver.
Did she acknowledge that?
Here in Boston.
So tell us that story.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
We were sitting, I don't know what we'd been doing here, but we were sitting in the back of a taxi discussing Flo's book, Abortion Rap, it was called. And the old Irish woman, probably as old as I am now, but anyway, I just remember she was Irish because of her name, you know, on the license. Turned around to us and said, honey, if men could get pregnant, abortion would be a sacrament. I so wish we had written down her name so we could credit her. I don't know whether she would want to be credited, but that sentence now has been heard around the world. You know, it's in demonstrations against the Vatican. It was outside the Republican convention. It was on T-shirts. You know,
the Vatican, does the celebration of the Pope, almost unfettered celebration, drive you crazy or no?
No, I think it's a good thing, obviously, that he came and talked about global warming. I'm very grateful that he did. Sorry. I apologize
That's
to listeners,
fine.
Right? Because, you know, he's recognizing reality and that's, you know, very, very, very helpful. But it worries me that he is part of an organization which, like all the other, you know, really patriarchal religions, encourage childbirth that beyond the point when it is chosen, you know, by individual women and men and so on. So that degree of pressure of people on the earth is part of the problem, and really, in a big way, the root of the problem that has led to global warming.
Despite the fact you're coughing, can I impose on you to read something? Since you just mentioned that you're not sure if the taxi driver would have liked you to have done that, you dedicate your book to this Dr. John Sharp. Would you mind reading what you wrote?
No, I'd be happy to.
This is the dedication in Gloria's book to this doctor, if you would.
This book is dedicated to Dr. John Sharp of London, who in 1957, a decade before physicians in England could legally perform an abortion for any reason other than the health of the woman, took the considerable risk of referring for an abortion a 22-year-old American on her way to India, knowing only that she had broken an engagement at home to seek an unknown fate. He said, "You must promise me two things. First, you will not tell anyone my name. Second, you will do what you want to do with your life." Yeah. "Dear Dr. Sharp, I believe you, who knew the law was unjust, would not mind if I say this so long after your death. I've done the best I could with my life. This book is for you."
Wow.
That's pretty great.
Yeah. You've got a lot of stories about traveling on college campuses, in the backseat of a taxi cab, talking to a lot of different taxi drivers. But one of the things that kept striking at my heart, because you said it right from the beginning, was about not having a home. You don't have a car, so you're really dependent on public and other forms of transportation. But you've changed in recent years, and you do have a home. And you say you enjoy traveling just as much now because there's also something to look forward to. Why did you wait so long?
Well, I think, we all have, I don't want to speak for everybody, but I think a lot of us have the idea as women that we're really only supposed to make a secure home for a husband and children. And for ourselves as single women, we don't think of it in quite the same way. So it took me a long time. And it helped me to realize that we both need both. You know, even birds have a nest, right? So I think our kind of primordial way of being is to travel with the seasons, to follow animals, but also to have a community, to sit around a campfire, to have a yurt, to have a, you know. So my father had no home. My mother had no journey of her own. And I think we both need both.
Now, is your sister still alive? You spoke about her.
No,
she is
not.
She was considerably older.
Yeah, she was 9 years older.
She had a more normal upbringing, I guess you could say. She did go to school.
Yeah, until she was six, you know, she had a very normal upbringing. And then my mother was hospitalized for 2 years, which I'm sure was very hard on her. This was all, you know, years before I was born.
And then lived with your sister for a while, too.
Yes, and she responded to our unconventional childhood in the opposite way.
Yeah.
I mean, she waited until 30 to marry, which in her generation was kind of late. And then she had six kids. And also after they were grown, became a lawyer and worked for the Federal Trade Commission. You know, she had a very full life, too.
So she waited till 30. Would you wait till 65? Is that what you waited? Isn't that what you waited to?
Well, and I confess, I mean, you know, it's interesting that people treat marriage, people would say things to me like, "You've waited all your life, at last you found the right person." You know, we love individual, unique people in individual, unique ways. It isn't as if I hadn't been in love with other people. And David Bale, the friend I married, as we referred to each other, had been married before and had kids. I mean, you know, we had full lives up to that point. And we actually got legally married because he needed a green card. He was born in South Africa. And I thought, well, we've worked 30 years to equalize the marriage laws, so why not? And also the other irresistible part was that Wilma Mankiller, the chief of the Cherokee Nation, offered us a Cherokee ceremony. I mean, who could resist that, right?
We're talking to Gloria Steinem for another couple of minutes here. Gloria, Jimmy Carter was kind enough to join us a couple of months ago after he wrote this terrific book. And he said, when we were talking to him, that the abuse and subjugation of women around the world, not only around the world, but here as well, is the worst and most pervasive and unaddressed human rights violation on earth, and he planned to spend the rest of his wonderful life. And this is prior to the cancer diagnosis, even though he keeps on keeping on, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago about what should happen in Syria. He said, that's what I'm going to focus the rest of my life's work on. What are your top two or three priorities? What are the things that are at the top of Gloria Steinem's
list? Well, first of all, I want to say how grateful I am to him, because he is taken seriously in a way that we women ourselves are not necessarily. I mean, he actually sat on the David Letterman show and talked about female genital mutilation. Yeah. I'm pretty sure that they would not let me do that. And so I'm immensely grateful to him. But I think, I think that what persuaded him is what persuades me, that violence against females, not because female life is any more valuable than male life, but because it is the first thing we see as dominance or violence, and it normalizes dominance and violence. The impulse, the male dominant or patriarchal or just political impulse to control population means controlling women's bodies, and that establishes a subject-object kind of relationship, which makes us think that such relationships are normal when they are not. The you know, many eons of early history, women controlled their own fertility with herbs and, you know, totally understood how to do that. Certainly it was true in Native American cultures here. And there was not that kind of subject-object, dominant-passive normalization of a power difference that also normalizes then class and race and caste in India and other kinds of dominance. And, you know, the idea that it's human nature, it tends to get confirmed in us, in our families.
So what's at the top of your list in our final 45 seconds? That. Do you not want to say, or do you?
This is it.
No, but this is it.
Yeah, this
is for
it.
You too.
Yeah, no,
for
no.
You too, fine.
Because I do think it's the root. Or a root, anyway, of the whole idea of human differential. And it establishes a subject-object relationship which begins a hierarchy. And the original 95% of human culture paradigm was a circle, that we were linked, we were not ranked. And that's, I think, something we are trying to get back to in a new way, in a future way.
Gloria Steinem, thank you.
We loved it. Gloria Steinem, My Life on the Road. I loved the book. Writer, activist, organizer. And Jim, is she going to be on your show again tonight?
I believe she will be with me at 7 o'clock tonight. So you can not only hear her, but you can see her at 7 o'clock on
Still
Greater Boston.
Gorgeous.
Well, thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, go ahead, Ray.
All right. Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer and Congressman Jim McGovern. Our production crew, Chelsea Mers, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, and Jason Tureski. Our engineer is John LaCroix Parker. I'm Emily Rooney, in for Marjorie Egan.
And I want to say also, the two women who won city council races will be joining me tonight.
Great.
And Stephanie Lydon has a phenomenal package on this Bostonian who has thrown hundreds of birthday parties for homeless kids, so I wouldn't miss it. 7 o'clock in Greater Boston.
Won't miss it.
Emily, it's been a pleasure
been fun, Jim. I'll see you Friday.
See you tomorrow.